dạy cho đồng được không?
Okay. You can just. Okay. This is Anne Morin. Today is June the 10th, 2005. This is an interview with Longsan Tseo of Portland, Oregon.
Hi, my name is Longsan.
I'd rather use. She wants us to say, I am.
Okay.
Okay, sorry.
I am Longsan Tseo.
Okay, wait a minute. I have this too close to
okay,
you.
Okay, too high. Huh?
Okay. All right, try it again.
I am Longsan Tseo.
Still too far. Okay, go again.
I am Longsan Tseo.
That's a little better.
And I originally.
Okay, we will be able to hear that. You understand that.
They're leaving now.
Okay. Nice to meet you, Wong, if I don't see you again. Okay.
They're going to the park.
Okay, good. All right.
So.
Oh, let's try it one more time.
I am Longsan Tseo. I originally came from Laos in 1979.
Would you please tell us a little about your childhood, your parents and your family, what they did, and about your schooling in Laos?
Thank you. I was born to a farmer's family. My parents were farmers throughout their lives. In 1962, when the communists took over our region, and we became refugees, that's when I had a chance to go to school to study Lao, French, and English. Although I was born and grew up with a farmer family, but throughout my school years, I was living by myself, and my parents were doing farming out in the village.
What kind of things did they grow?
Majority of the crops, the main ones, rice and corn. And of course, they have all kind of vegetables to go along with the rice and corn. And also fruits, too. We have very different kinds of tropical fruits.
And what did your dad... So your dad did farming, your mom... helped with the farming and stayed at home with the children?
That's correct. We have total 11 brothers and sisters. But my mother cannot stay home because she had to help in the farm too. My father alone was not able to produce enough crops or food for our family. Although only himself and my mother, but they have to pay for childcare. They have to pay for someone to care for myself, my brothers and sisters throughout the years.
Would you say your life was happy?
You know, before the war, we were up in the mountain, and we did not know anything about outside world. We only know the surrounding, the village. But after we became refugees and we were resettled in a refugee village, which is called Nam Keng, in northern Laos. Then we began to see foreigners. We began to see some American advisors who were advising or leading the soldiers in Laos. Also, some Lao officials who came to the area, the USAID officials who came and assist us in various capacities. They built us wells, schools, clinics. They helped us with farming techniques in the new area.
Why do you think they did this, Long San?
I have no idea. We just saw them and they gave us food, clothing, blankets or tools, but I did not have any idea why they were helping us.
As far as you know, they were just doing it out of the kindness of their hearts.
That's what we thought. And we thought they were going to help us forever, but unfortunately they helped us for only about a year and a half.
And then what?
And then they left. They left and then they said, they gave us tools, seats, and they said, you now, you have to stand on your own feet and you have to be independent.
And this was when?
That was in 1964, I believe, between 64 and 65.
So you are a little kid and you're in school at this time?
Right. I originally started school before we left, before we became refugees. Mm-hmm. But it was only a short time. And after we became refugees, we resettled in a new refugee village or new refugee camp, which is not a camp because we built our own housing. And that's where I started to go back to school again.
So, I have to push this little thing here.
Pause.
No, it's to let her know I'm going on to another subject.
Okay.
So, you're living in Laos. Everything is okay. What changed? What caused you? First of all, did you go into the service and then leave much later? Yes. So first you went into the Lao Army. How did that happen? How did you get involved with the Lao Army?
Well, when I grew up, when I was about 8 or 9 years old, that's when we became refugees. But before we became refugees, we saw refugees from other part of town, even from Burma, who escaped to Laos to seek refuge. So in 1962-63, when the communists took over Mueang Singh area, where I was born, when we became refugees, and then it was not safe because safety is the reason when we became refugees, because we were told when the communists came, they would butcher everyone. They will kill everyone, especially the kids. So once we became refugees, we moved to a new area. That's when we get opportunity to gain some education. And during my school years, I was recruited or drafted many times too to join the army, even though I was only 14, 15 years old.
Is going to sleep. You were recruited by whom?
By the Mien commanders, but the CIA were behind them. Okay. The American advisors.
So it's really the American advisors who are trying to get you to join the army.
That's correct. But fortunately, my teachers advised me not to go. And they told me what to do. They instructed me what to do to avoid to going to war or to become a soldier. And also...
What kinds of things did they tell you to do?
Well, one of my teacher who was very kind, and he advised me several things. But the first thing he told me that if they would let me be a leader, then he told me not to refuse. If they, as long as they appoint you to be a leader. Let's go. And he told me that because you can see most of the men, even the leaders, they don't even read and write any languages because they only know how to fight. But he advised me if they offer me a position, a high position, he rather want me to go because he learned a lesson from himself too. He said when he was in school, when he was young, he chose to be a teacher, and he never progressed. He said he stuck with his job the whole life, but his friends or his classmates who joined the army or who joined the the police academy, they became, colonels, generals, and he said he was too very ashamed to see them. So he advised me, if they offer me a high position, he would like me to go.
Okay, hang on just a minute. I'm going to put this on and make sure this is doing okay. I can't hear you as
you
well.
You edit everything, right?
Oh, yeah, everything will be edited, yeah. She will just use, we will use maybe 10 sentences.
Okay.
She will take whatever she thinks
she
is good. Yeah.
Okay.
Hang on just a minute. I have to move this here. Okay. It's, I don't know why it's going so loudly, but it just is. And so we'll just hope it's going to be all right.
A bit.
You don't have to speak loudly at all because it's picking up every single little thing here. Okay, so go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
That's all right. So I think they protected me for about 3 or 4 years.
Your teachers?
Right, my teachers and also the leader, our regional leader, the Mian leader who just passed away a few months ago.
His name?
His name is Chao La. He was the top Mian leader, also because the commanders the who came and tried to take me, they were under him. So he kind of removed my name from the list every time.
Am I incorrect in saying that my understanding is that there were even 10, 11, 12-year-olds who were fighting?
It's true. I didn't realize until... during my college years, I didn't finish my college. I went to college and didn't finish because of the war. And one of my neighbors came and asked my parents, because I dropped out already because of the war. They came and asked my parents permission to take me to the headquarters, the Mian military headquarters, to help them with paperwork, this and that. So my mother asked them, as long as you promise, if you do not send him to battlefield, then we will let him go. So they promised my mom, they were not going to let me go to the front lines, so I joined the army.
And you were how old?
I was about 19 years old. And luckily, they gave me back then, I thought it was a quite high position. I was an assistant company commander. I was leading about 150 soldiers. And as a young man, I was very proud of myself too. And people were jealous too. And then after I joined them, there was in transition between the Lao coalition government and then I think probably the permanent government, I'm not so sure, but it was ceasefire already, no more war, no more fighting. But many times that the communist soldiers tried to ambush us. And right after I joined the army, they sent us to a training camp to exercise for about 3 months. And that's when I began to know how life is in the army. We had so many recruits, they were under age. They were only 13, 14, unhealthy young boys. So we had to start from the scratch, and it was very, very difficult for me to train them. And as an assistant company commander, my job was to lead the group and train them because I was inexperienced. I was a new recruit. I had to learn from the scratch. And, you know, there were 3 or 4 other companies, And because we were the first company, they called us first, the first company, you had to take the lead. But most of our recruits were young, and including myself. I had to learn really hard. I gave them no break. I gave myself no breaks. We have to learn how to march. We have to learn how to go to battle. We have to learn how to sing in the evening because there was the moon was light. And it was in a camp. I didn't even let my soldiers rest. Each night I spent about 1 or 2 hours to exercise more.
Was this a guerrilla warfare they were learning and that you were teaching them? Or was this the kind of war that the CIA approved of?
Well, that was kind of between the CIA and the Lao government. But we were called special guerrilla forces.
And what does that mean? Explain to us what a guerrilla, how is guerrilla warfare different from regular warfare?
You know, I did not learn much about war until recent years. The war from the Bosnia, Afghanistan, or no, Afghan, also the Iraq war. Although I was in the army for about 4 years, I never go to the battle.
So you never saw any fighting?
I saw enemies, but because there was a ceasefire period. But two of my soldiers were ambushed by the Pathet Lao because they went to the village to buy food. And we thought...
Explain to us what Pathet Lao is.
Pathet Lao is the Lao communist, which is backed by the North Vietnamese. So two of my soldiers were ambushed, and we were far away. So when they radioed me for help, I didn't know what to do, so I had to radio the headquarters and then ask them to send a chopper to go to the camp and rescue the wounded soldier. But one of them was killed. So my job was to radio to the leader of the unit. So they went and rescued. Finally, they found the dad.
Now, how did you then end up out of the Lao army, and what happened then?
In late 1974, right after the Lao government formed coalition government, which is consists of the two provinces, they distribute or share responsibilities to guard Vientiane Chan and Luang Prabang. I mean, the forces were 50-50. After 2 years, probably a year and a half, Hua Kong province, which is where I am from, became the first province our troops joined them because the Mien was a minority and the other group was the Lao Teng, which is, they called themselves Kamu. They are the majority in the province, I mean, in terms of forces. They outnumber us by 3-1, and they are the one who were not happy with the government. So they join forces with the Pathet Lao, the Lao communists, and they came against us. And so we were outnumbered. We had no choice but to join them. We worked together for about 6 months, and I was sent to a political seminar for about a month and a half.
What does that mean, a political seminar?
Right. Political seminar, which is taught by the commanders from the Pathet Lao. The main goal for them was to teach us how to work with them. And against our own forces, against our own bosses, too.
So could you even say that you were prisoners, in a way, of them, or no?
We did not realize. We were probably under siege, but we were treated well. There was not much freedom. Although you were a commander, but you had to guard, too. At night, you had to take turns and patrol. Because the fear was maybe the Laos soldiers who escaped would might come back and attack us. So, but before we joined them, as a commander, at night time, you are on your own. You don't have to stay on guard because you have soldiers to protect you, and they're guarding for you.
Did some people not want to work with them and ran away, or did pretty much everybody stay?
You know, the more you learn from them is the more hatred I get from them, because what we learned was to hate the Lao government, to hate the commanders, the superiors, I mean our own superiors. And after we were released or we finished our training and they want us to go back to our units and then campaign and make known that the communist system is better or the Pathet Lao system is better, that's how they won. They go and gain control. So after I was released to go back to my unit, and then there was a period of about 3 months, we did not get paid. Because our salaries were held back, and they claim that because the coalition government stopped or closed the bank, and that's how that was why we did not get paid. But they said in the fourth month or the fifth month they are going to pay back everything. Not until the last minute that we learned the reason that they hold back our salaries was because there was. At the end, they will announce, okay, now everybody go back to the headquarters and collect your salaries. And that's when they took everyone sent to labor camp. Okay. But luckily, because I know I made some friends in a short period of time during about 4 or 5 months where we worked together. I made some friends from the communist side, and also I made some friends from the Lao. The Lao officers who were working in the headquarters. And one of the Pathet Lao's commander informed me that if I were you, I would rather go somewhere else. Instead of going to the headquarters and then collect your 4 or 5 months salary, you may not have a chance to come back. So he gave me that warning, and so that's why I chose to escape to Thailand. But I think I was maybe somehow told by God, I believe. And there were a few of my soldiers, I think about 16 of them, 2 platoon leaders. We all went home for vacation, for about 2 weeks vacation. So at the vacation, we all planned to go back to the headquarters and collect our salaries. But somehow, when the time came, I went ahead, but didn't go to the headquarters. I went about halfway and waited for everybody to meet me there. So when everyone got there, I told them that I was not going to go back to headquarters. Somehow, I got a gut feeling that it may not be safe. There must be a plan. So 15 of them believed me, and we all went home. And we all made it to Thailand. Only one older man, he thought, well, this is my salary, who cares? I will just go and get my money. And he never came back because he was the one that, among our group, who went to the headquarters and collected his paycheck.
So it sounds like the purpose of the communists was to train you to then go back to the Lao army and teach them what the communists wanted you to tell them and teach them, right?
Right. Right, the main purpose for them was to train us for about a month and a half and go back and then and campaign and teach others to join the communists, how great the communist system is.
Tell us about how then, when you decided, got a gut feeling that said, I'm not going back there, and you took off, then how long did it take you? What was that journey like?
The typical trip from where I live to Thailand was only about 2 hours. Or if you just hire a, pay for a boat and to take you to cross Mekong River, it costs you only maybe about 10 cents. But because I was in hiding, it took me over 2 weeks from my village to Thailand. The reason was because I was in hiding because the communists were looking for me. So I cannot go on the open road. I had to hide in the jungles, deep jungles, and pay for someone who knows the area to find a way for me to get out. And I was not alone. I was with my commander and also other 9 soldiers together at the beginning. But at the end, when the day that we made it to Thailand, we had only 1 soldier with us. Only my commander, myself, and then 1 soldier. Well, he was a medic for us.
What happened to the rest?
The rest, because it took so long, so they went home.
They gave up.
They gave up and they went home and just joined their families. And I think some of them were saved, but some of them were taken to a labor camp and never made it back.
So you arrive in Thailand and you go to the camp. And what is it like there for you?
After we made it to Thailand, we were sent into a refugee camp, which is very, very tiny and very close to the border between Laos and Thailand. The first refugee camp, we stayed there for about 8 months. And then more and more people were escaping from Laos. And because also the location was too close to Laos, and then I'm not sure, maybe the United Nations built a new refugee camp, which is in a different province.
What year is this?
It was in 1975. And then after the camp was completed, and then they moved us to the new camp, which is a little bit deeper than the first one. It was a little bit safer, only safer because we were not fear of the communists. But in the camp, there were so many things that we were suffering. Number one, because the camp conditions was so bad, the water, food, a lot of people got sick. Many people died from diarrhea, from illnesses, and the Thai people also, the Thai soldiers who got the camp were very, very rude, very cruel. Many of my refugee friends, they were put in jail for no reason. They have a curfew. If you do not follow the rules, you can put in jail.
And what's the jail like? I mean,
oh, the jail over there. It was uncovered. It's open. Rain or shine, you are there. It was on the dirt, and you have to work during the day. You have to carry waters for the guard or cleaning or do whatever they want you to do. And at night, you had to go and sleep there.
So you spent time in the jail?
Fortunately, I did not have to. When I was in the second camp, they assigned me as a building leader. There were about 42 buildings when I was there. That was before 1979.
How many people in a building about?
Each building, maybe about 300 or 400. And very, very crowded, buildings. And
how long would people live in these buildings?
They lived there until they were chosen or they were picked up by a third country. I was there from 1975 to 1979.
4 years?
4 years. I was in the camp for 4 years. There are a couple of reasons. Number one, I was recruited again by the our former commanders. And the hope for everyone was, sooner or later, we are going to go back to Laos. so you don't have to go to a third country. I was recruited, but luckily I didn't go to the training camp, because there was a training camp set up to recruit people and send back to fight in Laos. Luckily, I didn't have to go to that. I went to the meetings with them. I went to the planning meeting with them. After that, I withdrew myself because I didn't like it. There was nothing. I mean, we have to start from the scratch. And I asked one of the question to one of the former general who was conducting the training and recruitment. I asked them, who is going to support us? Before we lost the country, we were back. We were helped by Americans, the CIA. We have tanks, we have airplanes, we have jets, we have choppers, cargo planes, we had everything. We still lose the war. And now, who is going to do a better job than that? And I was told, nobody. We are the one who have to start from zero. So that was my final decision. After the training and planning, no, not training, but planning session, it was about 3 days planning session. We planned what to do in the future, this and after that I gave up. I told them, this is not for me.
Now somewhere in here you met your wife. Where did you meet your wife? And because you still, at this point, you're still not married, right?
That's correct. I and my wife actually engaged in Laos before I left Laos. But because the time was so short, I was in a rush. We had no time for wedding. So because I was on the run. And eventually I asked my parents to cancel our engagement because I didn't know what to do. I had to leave. My parents were staying behind. And at first we thought my parents would be safe, so they can stay behind and I just escaped to Thailand for my own safety. But fortunately, after I escaped to Thailand, my wife and her family made it to Thailand, so we met again in Thailand. But I did not stop there because my parents stayed behind. I went back to Laos two times. I went back to Laos two times from the first camp. It was very, very risky, very dangerous, but I made it two times because the first time I got two brothers and two sisters. And the second time I got my parents and other brothers out.
So you brought them to the camp?
Right, I brought them to the camp. And then we were back together again with my parents, my brothers and sisters, and then my fiancé. Later on, we got married in the camp, and we had two children in the camp, because during those 4 years, we had two children, two daughters. One was 2 years old, and one was only 2 months when we came. And we had our third child here in the United States.
So they were, when you came to the United States, you mean?
Uh-huh. Right.
Okay.
I want to go backward a little bit. The reason I spent 4 years in the camp was, the first, again, I already mentioned, the reason was the hope to go back to Laos. And second hope was that at the beginning, the United States government chose only people who associated with them back in Laos. I mean, worked very closely. The high-ranking officers or the government officials. And I thought I had no chance because I was in the army for only a short period of time. And there was in between the CIA time and the Lao government, in transition period. But I was helping them to interview people, to register people who want to come here, this and that. But my original plan was to go to France because I studied French in school back in Laos. And many of my friends also went to France. But after a while, because I was working with the delegates from the United States Embassy who went to conduct interview and register families who want to come here, I get acquainted with them and they asked me, why don't you go to the United States? My initial thought was I had no chance because I explained to them my reasons. They said, no, we can help you. So through the help, then I changed my mind. Although I submitted my application, everything to French embassy. Finally, I made up my mind and then I was accepted to come here to the United States.
And when did you leave the camp for the United States?
I left the camp in Thailand in 1979. I left the original camp, Chiang Kham was the original camp, but I stuck in Bangkok camp for 3 more months. Number one was medical, because I was sick in the camp and actually I had tuberculosis, I had TB. And I was in treatment for a year. And after I was cured, then because the x-ray shows that my lung was not good. And they put me on medical hold in Bangkok for 3 months. And we made it here to the United States in December, right after Christmas, December 1979.
And you landed in San Francisco?
We landed in San Francisco. We spent one night over there. I don't know where it was now. I know, just in the Bay Area. And I don't even know which airport, because it was not San Francisco airport. And somebody told me maybe it was a Chico. Somebody thought maybe it was Oakland, but I don't know, because I had never been to Chico airport, but I had been to Oakland airport, but it was not Oakland airport.
And I think you told me that you just went to this place, you were sleeping, and people would come in and say, okay, it's time for you to go.
Right. That was our next morning. The night we spent in San Francisco was the first night after we arrived, and then there was another Lao couple, a Chinese couple, who shared the hotel room with us. And next morning, about 4 o'clock, a Lao interpreter came and knocked on the door, and he took the Lao couple. And I asked them, how about us? He said, no, you're not going yet. So we went back to sleep again. About 6 o'clock something, then somebody knocked on the door, and then there was an American man who came and said, wow, what are you doing? We are waiting for you. The bus is waiting for you. And I told him, well, we were asked to stay because we know we were supposed to go, but the Lao man who came earlier said, you stay, you're not going yet. So he said, well, let's get everything and then go because the bus is waiting for you to go to take you to the airport. So we grabbed everything we had and went, yeah, bus, 5 or 6 bus line up and waiting for us. We were the last family they're waiting for.
So you get your plane and you're off to Portland?
Right. We bought in the airplane about 8 o'clock in the morning. We were headed for Portland, Oregon. And after we left the airplane, we met 2 beautiful ladies in the waiting area, in the terminal. And they were smiling at us, and because I was carrying a bag, says Long San, Se Chao. That was my last name, Se Chao. And they were looking at us and smiling at us, and I thought they must be my sponsors because I was informed in the airport before we boarded in the airplane. The gentleman who helped us was telling us that your sponsor is waiting for you at the airport in Portland. So I said, yes, I am Long San and this is my family, and they took us to their place. It was Colton, Oregon.
Colton, Oregon.
Right, Colton, Oregon, which is about 50 or 60 miles from Portland, east of Portland.
And is it a farm?
It was a farming community, a very small community. My sponsors were, the group who sponsored us was a Colton Lutheran Church. But the couple who took care of us was Mr. and Mrs. Anderson, and they were dairy farmers. They had over 100 cows.
Were they hoping that you would help them with the cows?
I don't know. I don't know what to do. And when we first came, you know, December was very, very cold. And they took us to church. They took us around. It was raining and cold, and I asked them, how much rain do we have here in Oregon? They said 60%. I asked them, how can we go to work? They told me that people work inside. That was the best feeling I got, because in this cold weather, I have to work outside, I may die. So they told me majority of people work inside, they don't have to work outside, so it made me feel better.
So what was your first job?
My first job was a custodian for school district, the Colton School District. How I got my job, I remember there was an evening they call International Church Service. So they asked people to bring whatever they have from, based on the culture, where they came from, this and that. So, because we were from Laos, we dressed in the Mian costume and this and that, and we took cook maybe one or two dishes of our Mian food, took over there and share. And they asked me questions, why are you here? What happened to your country? And I told them, well, we are here because our safety. If we didn't come here, we probably, the communists probably killed us already, because they were going after me. And I asked them back the same question too. I asked them, if your house is on fire, are you going to stay inside a house or get out of your house? They said, of course, I have to get out of the house. I told them the same situation I faced. My house was on fire, that's why I have to run.
Good answer.
And then the school principal asked me, do you have a job? I told him, no, I just got here 2 weeks ago. I'm looking for a job, and he offered me a job as a custodian in school.
And what was your educational background at this time?
I went to school only in Laos. I had a chance to study Lao. There was Lao and French were mandatory. They were required subjects. And also in the evening and on the weekends, because the kindness of our leader, he offered us ESL. He paid for a teacher who taught us English in the evening and on weekends. So I was fortunate enough to learn English.
But you also had some college.
Right. I had some college, but in college they only taught Lao and French, no English.
And not other subjects, mathematics and so forth?
Well, everything. They offer mathematics, geography, grammar, everything, but none of them in English.
Okay. Would this be equivalent to a high school education?
I would say so. They call secondary school, secondary education thing. That was probably equivalent to high school here. But people who graduated from secondary high school, they can be a teacher. Most of the government officials not even finish that level. Some of them finish, some don't.
How about culture shock? Some experiences that you had that were maybe funny and maybe sometimes not so funny.
Well, the cultural shocks were very new to us. When we first came, the first 2 weeks, we stayed with our sponsor's family. I mean, sponsors in their home. Our sponsor had a house with about 5 bedrooms, 2 stories. We stayed with them for 2 weeks, and during the first 2 weeks, the first 2 meals actually was shocking to us too. They cook, I didn't cook, and then they offer us very little food. And as a young man, I ate well. I was only about 25, 26 years old. After 2 meals, I was still hungry. And the third meal comes, when the meal time comes, and my sponsor, I asked her if it's okay for me to call her mom. And she said, oh, yeah, yeah, you can call me mother. So I called her mother. And when she was starting to cook, I asked them, mother, can I cook with you? She said, yes, you can cook. So I cooked. I cooked a full meal. And that's when we had a full meal. And our third meal, we had a full meal, and myself, my wife, and my kids.
Did they know enough to give you rice?
They gave us rice, but the long grain and very small bags, a bag of 5 pounds, this and that, and they expect us to have enough for about a week or two, and we finished in 2 meals. The other culture shock was, I think maybe the second or third morning, while we were living with our sponsors. I remember one morning, right after snack or breakfast, and Ragnar, who is the husband, I call him father, Mr. Anderson, he left home for a business trip in town. And we were still having breakfast on the table. And before he left the house, he gave his wife a kiss. And we were very uncomfortable because we were not familiar with the culture.
So in your culture, you would never have done that in front of someone.
That's correct. We don't even hold hands between husband and wife. We don't even hold hands in the public.
What must kids who went to high schools here in Portland have thought, Mien kids and Hmong kids and Lao and Vietnamese, actually, when they went into the halls of the schools here?
Well, the kids have become Americanized much, much quicker. And I think they probably adapt much, much faster than the...
Yes, because you didn't have to stand in a hall and watch people smooching right all over the place.
Right.
Okay. So now you've worked as a custodian in Colton schools, and then what? How did you move from that job to where you are now?
Working as a custodian in the school, the job which is I do in the evening after school. I work from 5 p.m. to about 11 p.m. or midnight sometimes. During the day, my mother, which is Mrs. Anderson, who I call mother, took me to Portland almost every week, almost every day to apply for jobs. Eventually, I was hired several places. They took me to several industrial factories. They hired me. I couldn't come to work because I didn't have any transportation to come to work in Portland. It was quite far, 50 miles away. No public transportation. I also was hired by Portland Public Schools because my sponsor took me to Portland Public Schools. I couldn't take the job because I couldn't find a place to live here in Portland.
And Portland Public Schools wanted you because you spoke English?
Right. They gave me a test. I remember who they gave me the test. I still remember their names. I met them only once, even though I still remember them. And then they gave me a test. And
who were they?
There were two ladies. One was Cheng Peng Lin, and the other one was Pat Furno, I believe. After I finished my application and they gave me an exam and they told me right away, we want to hire you, when can you start? And I told them, I don't know, it's up to my sponsors because they are the one who take care of me. And
how did it make you feel to have to say that?
Well, I have no choice because I was living with them and I was away from Portland. I knew a few families here in Portland, but I have no place to live. So I refer that decision back to them because they are the one who took care of us. If they say, okay, let's go, we'll find you a place, then I probably came. Or if they say, well, let's come to work, we'll find somebody to take you to work every day, then I probably come to work.
Hang on, my finger's going to sleep.
Okay.
I bet you could use some water too. I could too.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, so
let's finish the job, right?
Hmm?
Let's finish that.
Yeah, I think.
Finish the job part.
Yeah. So finally you got a job with Portland Public. And how did you arrange for a place to live?
Well, you know, I had to turn down the job eventually from Portland Public Schools, who offered me probably a second or probably third job I got here. But about the same week, I believe, my sponsor took me again to Portland. They took me to welfare office. They knew welfare office probably need someone who can speak more than one language. And yeah, she took me there and I filled application and they said they did not have any opening then. But they referred me to Indo-Chinese Center, which is Indo-Chinese Cultural and Service Center, who helped resettle refugees from Southeast Asia, who provide bus orientation, ESL, and job training. Also, interpretation service, because most of the refugees do not speak English, so they have to hire someone who assists them. I applied for a job there and went home. They said, well, usually the hiring takes place in September or October, because that's how the fiscal office works. I mean, fiscal year works. The fiscal year runs from October to September, and they said usually they hire in October. But I went home. They took me back to Cotton again. I applied for a job also at Tectonics. They hired me too. Couldn't go to work. But about 2 weeks later, Indo-Chinese sent a call and wanted to see me, so I came to interview, and they hired me.
And they arranged for a place for you to live also?
Right. After I got my job with Indo Chinese Center, and my sponsor said, well, let's go this time, let's move to Portland. So we moved to Portland, but still no place to live. I have to share room and board with one of my cousins for about 4 months.
And you had two children?
Right, I had two children then. I was on a waiting list for an apartment with Horsey Square Apartments, which is full of refugees, Hmong, Mien, Lao, Thai, Cambodian or Vietnamese.
So that's where you lived first, here in Portland?
Right. We lived in Horsey Square for about a year. Then we moved to St. John's, which is North Portland. And we lived in St. John for about not quite a year. We moved back to Horsey Square again.
Okay. So you went back to Horsey Square. Horsey Square, a lot of people don't know that that's a place that's considered a Mien sort of
probably
area.
Probably Mien village.
Yes.
Yes.
The apartments there.
Right. Yeah. Most of the apartment units were occupied by Mien families. And
what was it like to live there?
It was fun. It was good because there was probably the first place we live in Portland, and we like it because we get to live next to your family members. We know each other so well. They have a playground there. We can play volleyball in the evening, after work, in weekends, this and that. So we like it there.
People speak your language?
Right.
Today, I think I've heard that Horsey Square also has its problems.
Horsey Square apartments became Rose City apartments. They were sold to new owners. And to the help of the city government, they get a loan, a probably interest loan, no interest free loan. And right now, I think there are many problems there. When sometimes I drive by, I feel very insecure there.
Why?
Because we have not been. We have not been living there for a long time. When you move outside, when you go back to the city center, it looked very, very strange. And because the area became a high crime neighborhood.
Who was committing crimes?
We don't know. At first, in the 80s, a lot of people thought maybe the Asian gangs. And now, there are not so many Asians in the neighborhood anymore. We have other refugee groups living there, Africans, Russians, or you name them all. And we don't know. But still, this area is very high crime area right now.
Would the Mian people consider gangs a problem within their own culture here?
At first, most of the Mian parents do not accept that the kid were involved in the gang. Although they might know that the kids were in some kind of problem, get involved in some kind of activities, but they do not want to admit that the kids join gang. But until they were caught, and then the parents will say, "Wow, it's a surprise," because they don't want to seek for help. They want to keep it to themselves.
So part of it is they don't want to admit that there's a problem. Another part is maybe a little bit of shame. They're ashamed for their kids.
I think so. It could be both, yeah. They don't want to admit that their kids were bad kids. And because the fear and also a shame.
Plus, they didn't know much about what was going on in the schools.
Exactly, because the parents in the early stage, because the parents did not understand English, and the kids come home, the parents can't communicate with them, and they don't communicate well. And then, although the kids are in trouble, because if they don't share with the parents don't know until the school personnel inform them, and then they began to realize the kids were in trouble, and by then it's too late.
I think another problem that I remember is that kids were kind of in control in many households because they were the only ones who spoke English. And so they knew things that their parents didn't know and used that information sometimes.
That's correct, too. Most of the Mian families who do not, especially the parents who do not understand English, and then they just rely on their kids for communication, that's the fact.
Okay. You want to say the fact, because they won't have my voice here.
The fact is because they think what their kids told them were true, but actually, the kids were in trouble, but they did not share the sad part. So they do not know until when the community leaders get together and inform them or this and that, and they don't want to admit that the kids were in any trouble.
Were you a community leader in Halsey Square?
Yes. I was elected to be the president of the Mian Association of Oregon back to 1981, 82, I believe. Prior to that, the association was there, but not officially. After I was elected, not appointed, but elected by the community members, when I became president, and I told them that if they want to form an organization, then I would like to legalize without filing incorporation or incorporated. Then I told them I don't want to serve. So they all agree, and then we incorporated the Mian Association of Oregon.
And its purpose was?
The purpose was to act as a liaison between the Mian community and the public at large, and also to find ways to help the Mian families who are in need.
You mean in financial need or other kinds of need?
Not financial need, but in terms of other needs, language or culture, education or other family needs. We have officials in the Mian Association. We have the president, vice president, treasurer, bookkeeper, and we have board members. I was not alone. I mean, we have a group that people who were very dedicated to serve the Mian.
What were some of the things you did?
What we did, so many things, but I just named a few. One thing, though, we reinforced the ESL part. We asked every parent to take ESL classes. And also, within the first 2 years, we get a grant from, I think, Ford Foundation or somewhere to teach ESL and also the Mian literacy, actually, but back then because we taught Chinese.
Where did you have the classes?
We had the classes in Horsey Square apartment. And we had to pay two part-time teachers to teach the Mian culture and Chinese language. The other thing we also tried to help people to maintain our identity was we help people with embroidery. We find work for them to do, and also we find community gardens for them to do their own gardening. So families enjoy it because older family members, they have nothing to do during the day, and they want to go out there and do their own farming. They grow their own vegetables.
It must have been very difficult for the elders who came here. Couldn't work, and I suppose they helped take care of the little ones.
They do. The older ones, seniors, they do help with taking care of their grandchildren or their great-grandchildren. Also, as a community leader, we also have to find activities for them to enjoy. I remember we arranged field trips for them to go to Mount Hood, to go to Oregon coast, to have a picnic over there, to see the ocean, to see the fish. I remember that I arranged a few trips also to take them out. We also went to Kanita, the Indian reservation. We took elders there. They love it. And the Indians perform over there and this and that. Wow, they get a chance to see Indian culture.
There are many commonalities between Indian people and the many of the groups from Southeast Asia. I think you're saying that, and I have definitely noticed that.
Right. Too. Actually, the culture is probably quite similar.
Yeah. So what still needs to be done for the Mian people in Portland?
The Mian in Portland, there are still a lot of needs. Because people who came in early 80s or late 80s, many of them did not have a chance to go to school, to learn jobs, this and that. Now, many of them lost their jobs and then they want to get back to work, but they did not read and write. They do not read and write English, and it's still tough for them.
And the older you are, the harder it is to learn.
Right. Right, that's the main thing. Most of them claim that I can't learn, I don't want to go to school because I'm too old to learn. That's what they believe, and that's the attitude.
So do you spend a lot of time trying to convince them that's not true?
Exactly. I'm still trying. Many of them still have not become U.S. citizens, including my own family members. I have brother-in-laws, sister-in-laws who still holding their green card.
Do they hope to go back to Laos?
Not really. I don't think there's any hope anymore to go back to Laos. But I always inform them that this is their home. They have to learn how to live here. They have to become U.S. citizen, to have equal rights, this and that. But many of them still think, well, we are too old to learn, even citizenship. But my fear is that, my concern is that, I don't know how long they can hold a green card. And some green cards have expiration dates, some don't. We have families that who went to Canada, couldn't come back because they had only green card. They were in trouble because when the kids get the green card with a picture like little baby, and now they are grown-ups. They went to Canada, they come back on the way back. They were in trouble because the picture didn't look like them anymore.
So what happened to them?
And they had to pay. There's a fine for them to pay before they can get back to the United States. I think many of them have learned in a hard way.
But they did get back.
They did get back, eventually. But they were told, if the second time happened again, they're not going to allow them to come back.
So they would send them back to Laos?
They could. They could send them back to Laos, and Laos government is not going to accept them.
Laos would not accept them?
Right, because the Laos government, they were saying that this Hmong or Mien are not their people.
Oops. Do you want to answer that?
Oh, I think maybe that's my grandson.
We're almost to the end.
Okay. It's 5 minutes, right?
Yeah.
Whoa, 5 minutes, huh? I don't know. Good, I found 5 minutes. Oh, what? What? Yeah. Okay. Sorry.
Is it raining?
No.
Oh. Yeah, we're almost done here.
So now you want to talk about the success of the Mien?
Yes, please. That's I would like part, to know. Right? Yeah, what are some of the successes for the Mien?
Although most of the Mien, they had a lot of problems or they struggled from the beginning upon their arrival to the United States. Right now, I think nowadays, I would say the Mien is one of the most successful group who had no formal education from Laos. They used to be called the mountain people because they eventually moved from mountain to mountain in Laos.
They were slash and burn farmers.
Right, slash and burn farmers. And every few years, they have to move to a new area in order to get good crops. And in Portland area alone, almost every healthy man is working, both men and women. They all have jobs. I think over 75% of them own homes now. And many of them have their own home free and clear without any debt. And that's how the Mien, you want to have their life. They don't want to have any debts.
These are the younger Mien now, the kids, the people who've been here for a generation.
Mm-hmm. Well, most of the Mien who have been here for about 20 years already. The first two families who came here in 1976, and I would say the last families came probably 91. And that's the end of the refugee program for the Mien. And now, you would say young or old, because everyone need to go to work after a short period of time. And because they live together too. If a family of grandparents, parents, children and grandchildren, I would say four generations live in the same household. My family used to live in the same apartment, three generations. My parents, ourselves, and our kids. So three generations living in the same apartment unit.
In Halsey Square.
Right, in Halsey Square. I would say the Mien is one of the most successful group in Laos, but I don't think the public noticed that. We are the only one who know. Many kids have gone to school, got their degrees, bachelor degrees, master degrees, and a few.
PhDs, yes.
Right, eventually get their PhDs. And there are many, many more are following the footsteps. And Mien also work in almost every sector. The county government, the state government, I don't know anyone who work in the federal government level yet, but in the state, the county, the city, and the local agencies, and everywhere, we have Mien working there.
Maybe soon we'll see a Mien politician?
I would say so. Maybe in next 10 years, I would think so. Or eventually in the Mien, in the Bay Area, a few of them hold very high position in school districts too. I have a nephew, a niece actually, her husband is working as a school principal. in the Bay Area. And she's working toward that goal too, because she's working in the school district also. And I think at least two of them are the vice principals in the Bay Area.
What would you say has been your happiest experience while living here in the United States?
I think there are so many things that I would say happy, but one thing that makes me proud and happy is that we have a chance to live a free world, a free country, give you freedom, do according to your ability, do whatever you can to contribute to your new society. I also that I'm proud that we have helped, I personally have helped so many families succeed in this country, especially in Portland area. I remember back to early 80s, they just have entry-level jobs, general labor jobs. And now most of those people have their own homes. Some of them are in business, property management. Some of them would say millionaires now too. I know a couple of families here. They don't want to show that they are rich, but I would say a few families in Poland alone, millionaires now. They are very successful business folks, and because they take a risk. And I have one of my own cousins too, who went to school together in Laos with me, and now he owns two hotels in Poland area, one in Poland and one in Canyonville. And I know he make a few thousand, 100,000 each year.
Better not say too much there. You don't want IRS to hear.
Right. So these are just examples. So me and I are very successful. And many times that you run into them or they come to you and say, wow, thank you for your help. I don't want to credit it to myself, but to where I work.
And it must make you feel wonderful.
My uncle, Immigrant and Refugee Community Organization, which is formerly known as Indo-Chinese Cultural Service Center, throughout the 26, 27 years or 30 years experience, we helped so many refugees succeed, not only the Mian. Right now, we still depend on them too. I mean, the community members. We are supported by them. I mean, where I work, every year we arrange we call need assessment from the community, because we are a community-based organization. We want feedback from them. What can we do from here? What is the need out there for the community? What can we do to help the community? And we don't want to leave the community out. We want to work with the community, and we want support from the community. So I really appreciate what I do for yourself and then others, because I don't see a job just to make a living for yourself and you don't care for others. That's not the type of person who I am. Although people might not see you from outside, but my heart is with the community, not only the Mian community, but communities. And I'm so happy to see that many refugees succeed in this country. And they are big contributors to the society too. They pay taxes, they do everything that other people do, and many people may not know. And I still remember that when we first came, I took refugees to apply for jobs, and some employers said, these people cannot work because they are on welfare. And it's not true, because they do not know the fact. The fact is that these people are not here to collect welfare. First, they are here for their safety. Secondly, they are here to succeed. They want to build a new life here in this country. And I think in the future, for second and third generation, a lot of people, I mean, a lot of younger folks will be eventually be more successful. And I just don't want other people to think, well, you are here, you are an immigrant, or you are a refugee. You take away our jobs. It's not true. The jobs the refugees take, there are many local folks they don't want to take. Those entry-level jobs, minimum wage jobs that usually the local people don't want to take, but refugees, they don't care.
And the truth is, it shouldn't make any difference anyway, because they are American citizens and they have as much a right to good jobs as the rest of the American citizens who live here. That's my own opinion.
That's correct, yes. They know, well, some may not understand, I mean, refugees, some may not understand, because as a job worker, I have been working with the job service unit for 23 years. Many refugees are very reluctant from the beginning to accept entry-level wage jobs because their former occupation, I mean, back their homeland, there could be military commanders, officials, or government officials, or school teachers, or they have high-ranking position. But my job is to teach them. If you don't start, you can't finish. So they have to start somewhere. Just like a baby who's born, who cannot grow up right away. You have to start somewhere. So most of them, after an orientation session or counseling session, they became to realize entry-level job is the way, if they get a chance, they should start. And many of them made it to the top in a few years. And many clients that I place in the jobs and in entry-level positions, now they made it to, some of them became supervisors, managers, and many of them also even self-employed. I know a few families that I placed in cabinet shops, now they became employers. Almost. They own the company, their own business, and they hire more people. And they call us. I need someone, send me someone. One of my friends who eventually became an employer.
Right. What kind of a future do you see for you? What kind of dreams do you have for your own future?
Well, I'm over 50 now. My kids are grown up. I have one daughter who finished college, or two daughters who finished colleges, and then they are working, but they don't live with us anymore. And my son is still going to school. One of my goals is to support my children until they can stand on their own foot, and then they can be independent to have their own families, and then. For me and my wife, we plan to work until our retire age. And then maybe after we retire, one of my goals is to go back to Asia, either to Laos or China or Thailand, to educate those people. There are so many things that they need to learn from this country, the United States. We have so many good things for other countries to learn. And I think through my years of experience here, that you can take back to your homeland, and I think those people will really appreciate
I bet they would appreciate it.
Yeah.
I hear you. That's quite a dream.
Yes, I hope. I hope our dream will come true one day. I just finished one class last month. I took a Christian ministry. So one of my goals is to go back and spread the good news.
Mm-hmm.
And right now it's very tough because Vietnam, Laos, and China, you can't talk about Christ. Mm-hmm. You cannot spread good news over there. So one of my goals is to go back to one of those countries who really need help, first with the gospel, and then secondly with the new techniques that we learn, I think, to help people over there to develop.
I've heard some people say they went to China and didn't have to speak about their religion, just did what they did as whatever religion they were, and people picked up from their behavior and what they gave that, oh, this is a kind of a neat thing.
Right. Yeah. Yes, that's true.
Thank you so much for talking with us. We really, really appreciate it.
You are welcome, and thanks for the opportunity.